Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. Each week, I have a brand new episode of Big Books and Bold Ideas, a show where readers meet writers. You can catch it on Fridays or stream it anytime you're ready to listen. But every week, we also give you a deep track, a conversation with a writer from the archives. Now, you may hear a writer whose work gives context to the fresh episode, or you may hear a previous show with the same author. And I hope that will give you a sense of the arc of the writer's creative expression. You're here because you care about books and reading. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now, Dream Country. Reading a novel can change the way you see the world. Richard Powers' new novel, Overstory, did that for me. Writing one can change the author's life. That's what happened to author Shannon Gibney when an experience as a new college graduate 20 years ago would be the catalyst for the novel that is being published this month. The novel is titled Dream Country. It's a great read. Put it on your fall reading list. And Shannon Gibney joins me in the studio. Welcome. Really great to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Carrie.
So writer Julie Schumacher was in the studio last week, and we started ruminating on those what-if passages in your life. What if that teacher hadn't told me that I had this gift for this? Or what if I'd gone to that different college and gotten in with a different group of friends? You have that. You have that experience. That goes all the way back 20 years.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me about it.
Well, yeah. So I was lucky enough to be a new college grad and got this fellowship to investigate relationships between continental Africans and African Americans, which was something that had fascinated me for a long time. But, you know, as a creative writer, to look for stories of that. So I got this fellowship to West Africa.
May I just interrupt and say, this is a big deal, this award at Carnegie Mellon.
Yeah.
They only give it to one person.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
just to say.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. My PR people everywhere, I always say. Thank
All
you.
Right.
So, yeah. So, was thrilled to get it and was there for about a year. And this was some years ago. You know, I'm a woman of a certain age now. And so I stumbled really into this refugee camp, this Liberian refugee camp, Kamoa Buda Burim, right outside of Accra, Ghana. And
stumbled in how? Would you tell me how that happened?
I was staying with some friends and acquaintances that, you know, sort of like this tumbling rock, you know, where phenomenon where it's like, you know, you meet somebody and then they meet somebody else and then they tell you about this. Oh, and have you heard of this and whatever? And when you're 23, 22 and you're traveling and you're in a place for a year that's not your home and your job is just to be open, you know, you have no other things pulling on you. You know, I travel now, I've got two young children. It's like, okay, nah, I can't go over there to that cool noodle shop because I got to get back to my,
right.
to my kids. And so they were like, you know, somebody I met was just like, well, have you been to this refugee camp? And I was like, no, I didn't even know it existed. And then they were telling me about the Liberian Civil War. This was 97, 98.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know anything about that. And so I stepped on to the refugee camp and, of course, saw the Liberian flag, which is modeled on the American flag. And but, you know, it has one star. And
I didn't know this till I read the note at the end of your book.
No, I mean, so many of us don't know that. I mean, this also has to do with sort of, you know, the way that American history is told, the way it's taught, the way it's not taught.
Right.
I mean, my brain exploded when my friends were like, that is the Liberian flag. You are an African American. How do you not know your people's history of founding Liberia in the 19th century? It was founded by mostly former African-American slaves.
10,000 or so, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who went back.
Yeah.
I want to talk about this American colonization
society.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. In a minute. I just want to note also, though, that you were in Liberia at that point or in that refugee camp.
Yeah. Outside
of Ghana.
Mm-hmm. I mean, outside of Accra, Ghana. I'm sorry. In Ghana.
So at that time, check me on my history here, but hadn't Liberians just voted in a government for the first time at the end of a nearly 25-year-old civil war?
So Liberians call the Liberian Civil War, it was a 15-year conflict, but there were, all these 12 to 15 years. So there's all these sort of little breaks, right? So at that point, 97, 98, it was sort of like, things were still in flux and there was some idea that things were going to calm down.
Oh, okay.
And so, but they didn't, so it fell back into disarray. And I mean, at the end of the conflict, it was, some estimates are like 200 to 250,000 people had died. And this is a tiny country we're talking about. I mean, I think the population of Liberia now is it's about 4 million. That's roughly maybe a million more than the size of the metro area. That's a lot of the population. I mean, there's hardly anyone who is untouched and unscathed by this.
So you're in the refugee camp and you're, striking up conversations with people who are willing to tell you what they've been through? You're being a journalist in that moment.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is the interesting thing about me as a writer, a reader, just a human being, is like, I understand genre, but I always say, like, I don't really care. So it's like,
and what does that mean?
That means that I am most concerned about stories, whatever form they take, whether it's journalism. I've been a journalist for much of my life. I've been a creative writer for much of my life. I've been a poet. I don't ever really want genre to overdetermine or keep me from anything, any story that really calls to me.
I think a lot of writers would say that.
Yeah.
Don't you?
I mean, I think people would say that, but
I know. And yet the industry kind of shuffles you into genres. Mm-hmm. But so many writers feel that's restricting.
Yeah, it is restrictive. And excuse me. I think you have to definitely work hard to not be pushed, into certain corners.
You mean within the publishing industry?
Yeah. And also just within your own work. Yeah. You can definitely get into a groove of things where you are comfortable doing something, something, right? You have a certain amount of energy behind the kind of work that you're doing and support, maybe even. And so
the machine kind of cranks up and supports the genre.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is interesting. I read the novel and then I went back to read a bunch of interviews with you. And then I saw some little blurb just the other day about this book, and it said that it was a YA novel, and I kind of did a double take and thought that wasn't in my head. There's an example right there of how genre didn't matter to this.
Yeah, no, and I feel like I really kind of fell into that genre, and I'm still, honestly, I always say, learning about it, because I'm 43, and so the genre of YA itself really exploded sort of after I was in the age that it ostensibly is targeted towards, although a lot of adults read YA, right? Definitely, I mean, this book has multiple narrators from multiple backgrounds. It spans, 200 years, two continents, but all the narrators are young people, but at the same time, I mean, you could talk about, I always bring up, I teach Louise Erdrich's amazing novel, The Roundhouse, right?
Oh,
and that has a 13-year-old narrator, right? I mean, Joe, right? And he...
I forget that because that narrator is so brilliant.
Yeah. And just like so prescient.
Insightful,
and so,
right.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that we
Good
could argue
example.
That that's that, that, I mean, we could argue, right? That that's a why not? And I talk about that with my students. Like, what kind of a novel is this, right? I mean, this is a novel about the Roundhouse, right? Is a novel about jurisdictional violence that comes after Native women are raped and experience sexual violence.
And then the failure of the system to know what to do.
Right. And this young boy is like, it's in his hands, right? But he is 13, you know? So what makes that, that's categorized as a straight literary novel. And my book, you know, in a lot of ways is categorized as a YA novel. I think that... What I'm trying to get at is genre is fungible. And I think that also just my own identity, experience, and subject position, I identify as a mixed Black transracial adoptee, you know, a writer, an artist, a teacher. Like, I sort of inhabit all these spaces that are interstitial, if you will, between the between spaces. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, it's not surprising that my work also doesn't really fit.
So you tell me whether this is true. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine that this story would have unspooled in any other way and had any less or more meaning if you had sat down to say, this is not a YA novel and I'm not writing it as such. Mm-hmm. I mean, would it have been any different? Does it matter?
I mean, I didn't set out to write a YA novel.
But that is how it's being marketed.
No, I just set out to write a story, right? And this is what came out.
Right,
and
now
then
your editor is like, my editor,
Andrew Carr, who is fantastic. Yeah. And a lot of the work that he does is work that sort of pushes the conventional genre category of YA, you know? And I think that this also has to do with the sort of mainstream American conception of teenagers and also of childhood and youth. You know, like, I mean, the first character in this book, Coley Flomo, you know, he's this teenage, you know, Liberian refugee. It takes place in 2008, Brooklyn Center High School here in Minnesota. And, you know, there's all these kids of African descent at this school. And there's a big African immigrant population, but there's also this big African American population, and they do not get along. And he feels really like he kind of doesn't belong anywhere. his parents, you know, got the family out during the war of Liberia and then had to completely start over, you know, like many refugees and immigrants here in Minnesota. And so they're just trying to, like, survive and make it. But they also have all these cultural expectations of Coley that don't necessarily align with his experience.
This is something I noted about your characterization of the parents. Often when I read YA, specifically written as YA, the parents seem one or two dimensional. With your parents in this novel, I really did feel like I could see them from different perspectives, not just the teenagers, the kids, with their own complexity and their own ambivalence and their own needs, to figure this out.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I have a lot of compassion for Coley's parents.
I do.
Yeah. I have a lot of compassion. I mean, even the father, who is really a difficult person and really hard and really, like, unfair to Coley.
He's left the the father has left the family. He's with another woman. Mm-hmm. He kind of drops in and out of Coley's life to mete out some discipline and then goes away.
Yeah.
And yet, he is a sympathetic character.
Mm-hmm. Why do you say that?
I feel like the choices that he had to make were impossible, I sympathized with it. There was really no good choice in what to do.
Right, exactly. And you can see how those choices and the things that he faced, right, from the Liberian Civil War to, you know, immigrating to Minnesota and having to start over, right? This is a man who had a master's degree, right? And taught at this university in Liberia, but then he gets here and it doesn't matter, right? He just has to, like, start over in menial jobs, basically, because he has to feed his family. And there's a lot of, I think, unprocessed anger there. And here's somebody who, in a different section, we see him later in the book as a young person, right, around Coley's age. And he has this amazing dream for Liberia, that it's finally going to actually be this democratic space for indigenous Liberians who effectively have been locked out of full citizenship for, you know, 132 years, right? I mean, 5% of the population, the so-called Congo people, Americo-Liberians, the former African-American slaves who colonized Liberia all those years ago, 5% of the population effectively controlled 95% of the resources of this tiny country, right? So he's this activist, right? Coley's father, and he's, you know, he's like, our time is coming. It's going to come. And then what happens, right? Like the nation plunges into this disastrous civil war, right? And I don't know, spoilers, but you know, some other things happen to him.
Here.
His heart is broken.
I mean, the other thing is he is personifying, I think, in some ways, you probably know this better than I do, this idea that deep sacrifices were made and you don't have the option as my son or daughter to just fritter that away.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's a big burden to put on kids, but it's also a reasonable expectation to put on kids.
It is and it isn't, because he doesn't really understand Coley's daily reality.
Right.
I mean, that's the real tragedy of this book, right? I mean, for those of us who are parents, right? Where it's like, we love our kids, but we think we know so much of the time. Like, I know what you're doing. I know why you're doing it. I know, like, what your schooling is like, and you're just not applying yourself and whatever. And it's like, it's not that that's not true. It's just that it's not the full story, right? He doesn't see Coley, you know, like, the black kids, the African-American kids at school, you know, like, calling him names. And, you know, the first scene in the book is him getting, you know, hit by something that one of them throws at him. Like, he doesn't see just how completely violent, right? In a completely different way.
Mm, right.
His
right.
daily reality at this school really is.
What his understanding of violence, that's the other thing that you're showing us, is these different ideas of what violence is.
Yes.
And how he's really separated from the fact that that could be just as destructive.
It is
to
for
Coley.
Him.
As it was to what he experienced.
It is. And that's the tragedy of the book, is that it just keeps repeating. And I would argue, in large part, because they don't know each other's stories. They don't, nobody is, there's all this silence. You know, I was talking last night at another book event about how, you know, when most of us go through trauma, our response is silence. And it's completely understandable, you know. It's like this, like, retreating, you know, sort of instinct. But it has these other repercussions, right? Especially if it's intergenerational.
Were you talking about what's happening right now in our political arena? Or did you? I mean, as you're saying, as I'm thinking, this is part of the misunderstanding of women who are coming forward. And I don't just mean with the Kavanaugh thing. Mm-hmm. I mean with, why didn't they say anything about this? Mm-hmm. Why has it taken 20 mm-hmm. years to tell the story? Mm-hmm. That's part of the reason.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And I think that, I mean, what the book shows us again is that history and time and space, it's all happening right now, right? Even though this is, you know, 19th century Virginia, this is 19th century Monrovia, this is 1926 in the hinterlands of Liberia. This is, it's now. It is, you know, this woman coming out, as you were just talking about on the news, right? With these allegations right. against Kavanaugh. It's other women coming out, right? And people don't talk about things for good reason. They don't do it just because they're like, I don't feel like talking about it. They do it because they don't talk about it because it's painful. They don't have the words. They're trying to just survive and move forward and move on. And so, yeah, it's like you don't blame them, but it has these other effects.
Shannon Gibney in studio, if you've just tuned in to the conversation, we're talking about her new novel, Dream Country, some of the historical echoes, the way it informs contemporary ideas. And she's going to read a little bit of an excerpt in just a moment. Let's set the excerpt up.
Yeah, yes.
Let's talk about how what this American colonization society was. This was the idea during the antebellum years.
Yeah. So this was an organization, you know, founded in the early 19th century by white male elites. So a lot of politicians.
Some of whose names you will see on the Declaration of Independence. Yes,
yes. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, you know, Monrovia named after James Monroe, who was a prominent member, right? And I mean, this organization, we would like to probably say now that it was fringe. It was not fringe. You know, this organization received money from the U.S. government or U.S. governments, right? State and federal.
Wasn't Benjamin Rush's son, the physician who signed the Declaration, I think his son was involved?
Probably.
With this?
I mean, there's so many people. You go through the list and you're like, oh, my. Wow.
Yeah.
You know, and so these were folks, you know, many of them, as I said, politicians, business owners, plantation owners, slave holders, who were really concerned with the growing, quote unquote, threat of the freed black population in the country at that time. And so they came up with this scheme to, quote unquote, send them back. Right. To West Africa. As you said, I mean, they sent, 10,000, 14,000, a ton of folks back on ships, mostly during the 19th century. But the organization, I mean, it didn't disband until, I believe, like the 1960s, even though it wasn't active, obviously, at that point.
But I think we should also say that this was, and you allude to this, or you put characters right in the middle of this. This was a subject of debate.
Oh, yes.
Among black Americans.
Yes.
Some people believed they had to give up on America.
Yes.
And this might be the only way.
Yes.
Right. To live a fulfilled life.
I mean, that's one of the things that I hope that the book shows, too, is that, you know, black people around the globe, African diasporic people, and definitely African Americans, it's not a monolithic experience. And we've never had monolithic views on our experience. There was huge debate, you know, among African Americans about this scheme. And actually, most African Americans, including David Walker, who, you know, if you haven't read David Walker's Appeal, I mean, he was just, I mean, really an amazing orator about black liberation and whatnot. And I have a quote by him in the book, actually, that opens up this 19th century section. But they were not fooled by this ACS, American Colonization Society, scheme. They were just like, this is not going to get us where we need to be, where we deserve to be, given what we have been forced to contribute to this country. And we're not leaving. You know, most freed blacks were like, no. Right. But this character, Yasmin Wright, right, in this section, she is a widower. She's got four young children.
It's 1828.
Yes. Right?
She has to decide.
She's got to decide. Like, you know, she takes, what she does is she really takes a clear eyed, I think, from her perspective, look around, right, at the conditions of black folks in and around Norfolk, where she's, where her family is. And she's got a baby, Lainey. She's got Nolan, who's six. She's got little George, who's 12. And then she's got an almost grown son who's around 18, big George. And she's like, I'm not seeing it. I am not. I have no confidence, actually, that this country is actually going to give me and my family and my children, especially the kinds of opportunities or any kind of equal citizenship.
Rise to its better angels,
no.
Right? As she doesn't believe that.
And she has no reason to.
Right.
I mean, there's a scene in the book where they're walking from this Quaker plantation where they have lived all their lives and worked. And they witness, they witness a slave auction, you know? And she's just like, yeah, this place is not going to change.
Would you read a little bit from this section? This is where she is about to board the ship. She's made the decision. She's about to board the ship with her children for Liberia. And her young son suddenly realizes kind of what this is going to mean.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Mama, I don't want to go no more, said little George, wiping away the tears that streaked across his cheeks. Ain't it all right for us to stay here now? This place is so much better than Master Scott's. No need for us to get in the ship. Yasmin pulled him into her side, hugging him as they headed toward the walkway onto the ship. My George, there's so many wonders on the other side. Wonders we can't even imagine yet. Plus, we're going to have our own house, our own garden, and we're going to find us some new friends. Little George nodded reluctantly, clearly trying to get on board with his mother's plan. I don't want a new home, Nolan said stubbornly at her other side. Besides, Melina says you can only ever have one home, and this is ours. Yasmin laughed. You be home when you're with your family, she said firmly. The phrase her father had told her so many days of her life solid in her mouth. And we be with one another, always. She stopped to kiss the top of Nolan's head, then turned around for one last look at the bustling port of Norfolk, at the men and women selling fish at the docks, at the filthy shipyards and the equally filthy men who built the ships that sailed in and out of port each day, at the haughty whites who knew they were better than the coloreds, and the poor whites who knew they were too. She looked finally at the army of coloreds walking behind their masters, walking alone to complete some mundane task, at the colored children who were doomed to follow in their footsteps, and whispered, goodbye.
Shannon Gibney reading from her new novel, Dream Country. That passage, I'm sure, deliberately echoes what we were talking about a little earlier with a parent having to make a decision and a sacrifice for their child's future and how that's reversed and what we're learning about Colley and his parents at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for them, it's very similar, I think, to what goes through Yasmin's mind and heart in that moment, which is I'm saving my child. I mean, from a Western point of view, this idea, you know, I first heard about it when, you know, from my Liberian family, I was married to a Liberian for 8 years. And I kept on hearing these stories of these teenage boys that were sent back to Liberia because, you know, in the words of their family members, primarily their parents, like they were just out of control. And they felt like they were really going to die if they stayed where they were in the United States, in their schools, et cetera. And again, as a Westerner, as a cultural outsider, I mean, this was just an anathema to me. I did not understand it at all. And then I really, you know, I started talking to more folks. There were two young men who, I mean, I said this last night too, you know, my name is on the book, right? But it's like, I mean, a project like this, a book like this, so many people have contributed to the book. So many people have been so generous with sharing their stories to me, with me, that I feel like, it is my book, but it's also not my book. It's so many other people's books. So these young men told me, you know, one in Monrovia, Liberia, when we were there about 2.5 years ago, was actually deported at 19 for selling drugs. And then another one who, by all intents and purposes, is a success story, was getting into all kinds of trouble here in Minnesota. And his mother didn't know what to do, sent him back. He was there for 5 years, came back when he was about 20, got this great scholarship to this state school, a sports scholarship, and was about to graduate. But, I mean, both their stories were very complicated, and they had a lot of anger, you know. And I think, from my point of view, rightfully so. I also understand their parents' point of view, though. Right. You know, they don't understand the American school system. I know as a Black parent, not an African immigrant parent, but I know as a Black parent of Black children, you do feel like these schools are out to kill your children sometimes. I mean, you really do. And so just simply because they're Black. And then to have the added layer of not sharing the dominant culture, right, is a whole other thing. And so I do feel like Coley's parents really believe, like, they are saving his life by sending him to Liberia. Now,
as
he doesn't agree.
Yasmin believes as well. She's getting on the ship.
Yes.
Can I say that without, again, revealing this, The choice you made about what would happen to Coley was unexpected and pretty delightful.
How do you say more about that?
At the very
at the
what
end.
He becomes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you resisted, I think, the what might have been a temptation to say, ta-da, and it all, and this, and this.
Yeah.
And now you know his name. Mm-hmm. He comes back to live a pretty ordinary life.
Right. But
Liberia is good and bad for him.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good.
Yeah, I mean, by his sister's point of view, from his sister's point of view, it was not necessarily the right thing to do.
Right. And by Coley's point of view, right? But what about the objective observer kind of looking in on this family?
Right. I mean, and I think that's another thing that the novel asks us. Are there any objective observers? You know, we can say that one, Coley's alive, right? I mean, there is that one line that his father says before they send him out. He can be mad at us, but he'll be alive.
Right.
You know? So I think by that standard, yes. By the standard that, yeah, he's like a professional. He's been educated. You know, he's well adjusted. You know, sort of by these like very, you know, sort of like global Western white standards, like he's good, right? But the problem is that his sister is bringing up is that their family is just sort of like a train wreck now. I mean, there's nobody talks, period, but certainly nobody talks about all these chasms and all this violence and all these things that have happened. There's no through line. There's no story, which is why she spends her, you know, she spends like 3 years of her life writing this story because she's like, I can't live like this. I can't not have some kind of semblance of a story and narrative that is informing me about why the people I'm supposedly closest to in the world, like why we don't understand each other. We don't know each other. So in that sense, it's like, it's not a happy story. But it's interesting to me that you say that like everything is not resolved. I think that that is a really common response as I've done the more events I do and the more people I talk to with the book being out in the world now. So people are like, well, I like this book because it's not like this easy resolution. No,
absolutely. I've been looking forward to asking you about something that you wrote, and I don't want to miss a chance to do this. You wrote a piece for Writer's Digest a few years ago in which you wrote about the seven things that you'd learned so far about being a writer.
Yes.
And you really tried to dispel the romance of writing.
Yes.
I find this interesting because you teach creative writing. You said, the cold, banal truth of the matter is that day in, day out, writing is about as sexy as doing your laundry or teaching that class or weeding your garden. Your creative writing students, there's something about the idealism of imagining yourself as a writer and aspiring to it infuse those students and drive them on.
Yeah.
Where does this fit into that?
I think that there's this idea that kind of, you know, well, I can only write if the muse is upon me. And, you know, and I'm going to butcher this quote, but, you know, there's this great, great quote, and I can't remember who said it now, but he was like, you know, the difference between seasoned writers and beginning writers is that seasoned writers write through the bad days, you know? And I think that that's true, right? Like if you're constantly waiting, you know, for like, the inspiration and the right conditions and the whatever, you're never going to get anything done, you know? And then so much of writing, I always tell my writing students, whether it's creative writing or composition, is revision, right? I mean, so.
And that's about as unsexy as the laundry too, right?
It is difficult. And then, you know, when you have to cut stuff that isn't working and you're like, that's my arm and I have to cut it. Yes, you have to do it, right? So, yeah. Yeah. It's writing is I did hear the writer Jonathan Lethem, you know, and this was years ago, and he was talking about, I think his father was a painter. And he's like a very prolific, very interesting writer. And he was like, you know, it was the process of writing was demystified for me very young because my father was a writer. I mean, I'm sorry, my father was an artist. So he was like, you know, other people's dads went off to the factory. My dad like went to his studio and like shut the door and then, you know, emerged, you know, 6 or 8 hours later or whatever. And so it just is like, no, this is something you do. You put the time in, you put the energy in. Obviously, you know, you do it because you love it, right? Because it's so hard. And artists we know don't get generally a lot of positive reinforcement from whatever communities they're in. Yeah.
I hope you're getting lots for the novel.
I am.
Shannon, thank you for spending the hour with me.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you here. Shannon Gibney's new novel is called Dream Country. Put it on your fall reading list.